Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to start our program by taking a look at a new book that's out by Peter Annan. The book is titled The Great Lakes Water Wars, and in this book, Peter takes a kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the battles that are being fought locally, statewide, federal, international levels to preserve the world's largest container for freshwater, surface freshwater on the earth, the Great Lakes. Really a pleasure to have him along and to talk with us about his book. He's actually in St. Paul, where he'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at in the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Center for Community Building in St. Paul. So we'll let you know that if you're in that area. And he'll be in Madison, Club 5, East Wilson Street, tomorrow evening. That's Thursday night, March 29th at 7 p.m. Each event is free and open to the public and sponsored by Northland College, the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute, and Audubon, Minnesota. So we're really pleased to have him along today to talk about the issues and to talk about his book. And certainly, if you want to chime in with your own questions or comments, you are most welcome. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, or elsewhere, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on board. Peter Annan, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
In your first chapter, you kind of lay out the issue, the overall issue, and it's kind of a disturbing chapter, chilling chapter, I guess, to read in some respects. Talk about the current situation with water.
Yeah, I mean, the global water situation is a bleak one, and no other way to describe it, and that's what the first chapter does. And what I try to do is put the abundant water resources in the Great Lakes into an international picture, as you already mentioned. And but right now, 1 billion people with a B, billion with a B, do not have access to clean drinking water around the world today. 2 million people die annually from unhealthy water conditions, and by the year 2025, the United Nations predicts that two-thirds of the global population will suffer from regular or frequent water shortages.
That's an amazing figure, and it's not that far off.
It's really not. And so the thesis of my book is that as the global value of clean, fresh drinking water increases over time, that sooner or later the thirsty people are going to come calling at the water-rich regions of the world like the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and we've already, as you point out, there have already been some ideas floated around for the Great Lakes, piping water to the west and that sort of thing, big tankers filling up with the water and taking it somewhere else.
Yeah, it's certainly not a new idea to take Great Lakes water and send it elsewhere, and there have been plenty of far-fetched schemes and less far-fetched schemes and plenty of precedent, actually, of poking and prodding in the Great Lakes Basin and sending water in here and taking water out there and that sort of thing.
And you in your book, and it's some really fascinating stories that you tell about various places, certainly the Great Lakes, but you also talk about the Aral Sea, which was a fascinating story and can, I guess, show what can happen to a large body of water when it's not cared for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in the Great Lakes water debate, the Aral Sea is often referred to by advocates and different people in different debates and discussions. Yet what I found is that most of the people who refer to the Aral Sea had never been there. So I thought it'd be a good public service to go to the Aral Sea, located in a remote part of the world, Central Asia, sandwiched between Kazakhstan to the north, Uzbekistan to the south, and tell the story of the Aral Sea in one quick chapter and let the residents of the Great Lakes region decide for themselves how relevant it may or may not be. What it showed to me is that, you know, you had this fourth largest inland body of water in the world, essentially a Great Lake in its own right. was a victim of a massive Soviet agricultural engineering and irrigation project to divert the feeder streams to the Aral Sea and make the desert bloom. The desert did bloom, but at huge cost to the Aral Sea's ecosystem. And now, if you can imagine this, Larry, it takes 5 hours to drive in a four-wheel drive vehicle from the old water's edge at the Aral Sea to the new water's edge. That's how far the Aral Sea has shrunk. It's lost 90% of its volume, 75% of its surface area. And there's been a bit of a controversy about the book, because I don't allege in my book that this is what's going to happen in the Great Lakes. I don't allege that at all. But what I do, my conclusions that I drew from my visit to the Aral Sea, is that you can't stand on the edge of the Great Lakes, any one of them, and say, these water bodies are so massive that they're invincible, that we don't have to worry about overuse, oversubscription, because they're so large, because that's not the case at all. You can't say that after you go and see, really, the horrific environmental aftermath of what's happened at a place like the Aral Sea.
Yeah. Let's get some callers online. Again, if you want to join us, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Leanne in Heartland, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. We're sailors, and we have a boat on Lake Michigan, and our boat used to always be even with the dock, and now we have to build steps going down to it because it's like 4 feet below what it has been. And this has been, like, for 5 years. The water used to always fluctuate, you know, in different cycles, but it's never been this low that since we've been sailing there.
Hmm. Comment, Peter?
Yeah, actually, this is a really big issue in the Great Lakes right now. The Great Lakes fluctuate naturally over time. It's called, the scientists call it natural variability. And it's actually quite extraordinary how much natural fluctuation there is in the water levels, particularly of Lakes Michigan, Lakes Huron, and Lake Erie, which aren't regulated by dams like Lake Ontario and Lake Superior are. So these middle lakes really have fluctuated wildly over time. 6 vertical feet separates the all-time high from the all-time low on Lakes Michigan and Huron. So if you live on a cliff, you've got a 6 vertical foot drop. But if you have what most people have, which is a gradually sloping beach line, and that water drops 6 feet, it actually can go out 100 yards or more. Now, humans want lake level consistency. We put in our dock, as Leanne was talking about, we want that boat to be at the same level all the time. In fact, the environment and the ecology of the Great Lakes relishes this inconsistency in water levels, this invariability. And that's because these mud banks that become exposed over time, those are seed banks for rare plants that may have been waiting decades for the light and air to grow. And then they emerge from these new wetland areas, and they create a nursery for neotropical migrant birds and waterfowl and that sort of thing. And then over time, what seems like a long time to humans, but what's not a long time to the environment, maybe 10 years or so, the water levels have always come back up, and they've come up some over time very high, and that bird nursery turns into a fish nursery, and small minnows come in there and they hide from predators. Fish build nests in there, and those decaying plants become fish food. And that's the natural system, and it's very alarming to humans, and we need to realize that that's part of the natural scenario. Now, let me talk about what could be very alarming, which is climate change. And there are predictions that lake levels in the Great Lakes could fall by an additional 5 feet permanently because of climate change by the end of this century. So that's 5 feet on top of the 6 feet that I was already talking about. That is a big deal, and that's what we all have to potentially really worry about in the future.
Yeah. Thanks, Leanne. Ryan in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. As you mentioned, the Great Lakes is, you know, merely a reservoir. There's other watersheds, such as the Mississippi, which have far more water than the Great Lakes. What is the excitement about the Great Lakes for removing this water?
Yeah, and you know, there's just something about, they're just captivating, you know, their size, the fact that they hold 20%, just under 20% of all the fresh surface on Earth is right here in the Great Lakes Basin. That's one thing. And then the other thing, this is just a fascinating statistic that I put in my book, you know, if you were to take all that water from the Great Lakes and flow it all over the lower 48,
yeah,
the lower 48 would be covered in 9.5 feet of water.
That's amazing.
It's just an amazing amount of water. And so that is really captivating. It's really captivating to people in the West in particular who see undeveloped water as a wasted opportunity. They it's like any other abundant natural resource. It's always attracted interest over time, and it always will.
And when you have climate change like we're having, and actually, as you, I think you talk about in the Aral Sea, the climate, the sea had an effect on the climate and actually changed the climate when the water went down.
That's right. You know, when they talk about how, you know, it's such and such temperature in Madison today, but it's cooler by the lake in Ashland, and it's cooler by the lake in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And then when we also have climate that's impacted by lake effect snow, which comes deep into Wisconsin and Upper Peninsula and other parts of the Great Lakes Basin, that is a microclimate that is created by the Great Lakes. Big lakes like Superior, Michigan, et cetera, they create their own weather. So a storm system comes through and it changes. A front comes through and it changes when it hits the Great Lakes. And if you take away the water, which is what happened in the Aral Sea, that moderation of the climate is gone, and then you have much more severe extremes over time. And so there are many different layers of consequences from these kinds of decisions.
Yeah. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Phil.
Hey, excellent topic. I read this book about 2 months ago, and I'll give him 6 stars on Amazon, even though they only allow 5. It was super well written. Now, my question for you is, I grew up in Addison, Illinois, and you had a blurb in the book about, I believe, Villa Park in Elmhurst, Illinois, I believe in the 40s, being given access to Lake Michigan water. They're 19 miles from the lake, and I read that, and I thought to myself, this is the elephant in the room. Whoever let this happen? Can you talk about the politics of how that happened? I asked my father, who's 85, and he said, I remember when that happened, and he said, I thought to myself, somebody's going to pay a price for this for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Phil, first, thanks for your kind words. It's very nice to hear after working so hard on the book for so long. But let's talk about the Chicago water situation, which is the most controversial in all the Great Lakes. And so we have to go back, and Larry, give me just a few minutes here.
Sure.
To get to paint the historical picture. So we go back to the late 1800s. 1871, Chicago's decimated by the Great Chicago Fire, and it's rebuilding itself. It's rebuilding itself with a lot of timber from Wisconsin and other Great Lakes states, and it becomes a thriving, booming, really important metropolis in the central part of the nation, and it has biblical sanitation problems. I mean, just extraordinary. The infrastructure can't keep up with the people. It can't keep up with the stockyards, which are teeming around in the south side of Chicago, and all this sewage is running into the Chicago River. The blood and guts from the stockyards are being washed off in the Chicago River. The Chicago River is a stinking, slow-moving pit of filth, and it is creating serious standard of living problems within the city itself. But then you get these huge summer rain events, and it would flush all this garbage and debris into the river, out into Lake Michigan, out miles from shore. And the water intake structures for Chicago are 2 miles off of shore, and there's anecdotal evidence of dead cats and horses floating that far out, and the sewage slick clearly visible to boaters out that ship out in that area. And so Chicago became extremely frightened that it was on the brink of a major health disaster, and something had to be done. And the classic city of big shoulders thought really big, and they embarked on a massive engineering project to reverse the flow of the Chicago River and send that filthy water south to St. Louis.
Yeah.
which was extremely controversial, as you might imagine. It also was a multi-year engineering effort where it took 8,000 men several years to dig a 26-mile canal, which still is in existence today. It's called the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And that connected the upper reaches of the Chicago River to the Des Plaines River, and then to the which flowed into the Illinois River, and then the Mississippi River, and obviously down to the Gulf of Mexico. And so what happened was, when this diversion opened in 1900, it began sending billions of gallons of Lake Michigan water in the opposite direction, down to St. Louis and ultimately the Gulf of Mexico. St. Louis, Missouri, sued on behalf of St. Louis, and we went into the federal court, and the Supreme Court justices, after long cases and stacks of testimony from experts, said because other communities on the Mississippi River discharged their sewage into the Mississippi, the justices couldn't tell whose sewage was whose. And so Illinois got off the hook. Wisconsin, this was a period of low water levels, and Wisconsin then sued, blaming Illinois for what seemed to be even lower water levels than people had witnessed in the past. They demanded that the diversion be shut down or at least reined in, and that Supreme Court case continues today. Wisconsin et al. Versus Illinois is an open file at the U.S. Supreme Court. Other Great Lakes states came in and joined them. And so what happened was the Supreme Court put the limits on this diversion in 1967. The case continued on in 1967. Illinois lost the first round. The Supreme Court definitely reined it in. And then over time, it has expanded this water allocation to the point where today it's 2.1 billion gallons of Great Lakes water is diverted outside the Great Lakes Basin to the Gulf of Mexico every day on behalf of Chicago. Now, what's been interesting over time is sewage technology has improved. Chicago has needed less and less of that water to flush and dilute its pollution, and more of that water has been used for urban sprawl, for fueling the water needs of Chicago suburbs as they sit upon declining aquifers, much like southeastern Wisconsin, Waukesha, and places like that. So here you have this long-standing Supreme Court case that's more than a century old that allows Chicago to send Great Lakes water outside the Great Lakes Basin divide, as Phil has correctly pointed out, while other states like Wisconsin and Indiana and places like that have to go through a big, long application process and can be denied those kinds of things. So it's a long answer to a very good question, but the Chicago diversion is the poster child of bad behavior in the Great Lakes that no one ever wants to see happen again.
Yeah, and I want to talk some more about that and about the compact that is still in the works as well with our guest Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Wars, fascinating story about the diversion issues, the sort of the history, the kind of the hidden history. Not everybody knows about it, for sure. He's done a lot of research on this and has written it all into his book, The Great Lakes Wars. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Peter Annan today about his book, The Great Lakes Wars. Peter, by the way, is Associate Director of the National Nonprofit Institutes for Journalism and Natural Resources. Pleasure to have him with us. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in St. Paul, Minnesota, at the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Center for Community Building. And then he'll be speaking at the Madison Club in Madison tomorrow night, and that's on 5 East Wilson Street. Both of those events are free and open to the public, and certainly I'm sure he would love to have you come and visit and talk with him and hear what he has to say. The compact I'm talking about, and we've discussed this on the program in the past, but maybe you could go back and talk a little bit about the compact that the eight states and Canada surrounding the Great Lakes have in works.
Yeah, so we have the Chicago diversion we just talked about. There have been several other diversion proposals over time that brought the Great Lakes governors and premiers together to create a management system to essentially deny diversions as much as possible. I mean, that's the overall goal. The problem is that system hasn't been working very well, and it's been leaving a lot of people disgruntled. There's a lot of concerns that the federal law that currently controls diversions outside the Great Lakes Basin is unconstitutional, and the only reason it remains on the books is because no one stepped forward to challenge it. And so in 1998, when the NOVA group came forward to ship tankers of Lake Superior water to Asia, and that proposal actually slipped through all the regulatory rules that were on the books at the time, that's when people said, all right, look, we've been struggling for decades with this broken water management system. We need to create a modern, binding, world-class water management system to protect this internationally significant resource for the next 100 years and beyond. And the water managers throughout the Great Lakes Basin sat down for years quietly negotiating behind the scenes and also having public hearings, keeping the public up to speed with where the negotiations were heading over time to create a new modern binding water management system, and it became known as the Great Lakes Water Management Compact. And it was released in Milwaukee in December 2005. And in it's essentially a ban on diversions, with a few very limited exceptions that have high hurdles for people, water applicants, to come forward to. But the vast majority of water applicants would have no standing under the compact. The problem is that the compact, after all those years of work, is just a document right now. For a compact to be enforced, it needs to be adopted by the legislatures of all the relevant states, in this case the 8 states in the Great Lakes Basin. Then it needs to be adopted by Congress. Obviously, a multi-year process. Compacts have taken 10, 20 years to pass in other parts of the United States. And so right now, we've just got some momentum. Minnesota just passed the compact earlier this year. Wisconsin has a special legislative committee that's looking at it. There's legislation that's been introduced in other states throughout the Great Lakes Basin. And it's what's really interesting about the compact, in my opinion, is that we always whine and complain about politicians not looking ahead, waiting till the last minute, waiting till a crisis before we act. But here we have a situation where they're doing the opposite of that. They're moving and looking forward in the absence of a crisis, when hopefully it will be easier for us to, have responsible policies adopted.
Yeah. Tom and Mequon, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Interesting show, Larry. I've got a question and a comment. My question is that how much higher would the Lake Michigan water level be if the Chicago diversion wasn't in effect? And along with that, I keep hearing people say, well, Lake Michigan's low, Lake Michigan's low. Well, isn't that one of the major reasons why it's low? And I'm wondering, how many feet would it be higher if that was closed? And my other thing is that I believe that the clean water we have here in the Great Lakes should stay here, and that if these businesses are interested in our water, well, they should come back here to the Rust Belt, to Michigan, to Illinois, to Wisconsin, and then they'll have access to it. Otherwise, we should not be able to sell it or give it away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are great points, Tom. And essentially, the governors and premiers agree with you. And the trick for the compact was to protect the Great Lakes from diversions and irresponsible water use, but also make sure that water was available because it is such a cornerstone of our regional economy. And so and that's what they've tried to craft here, is sort of the magic bullet that can prevent long-range, large-scale diversions that would damage the lakes, but also allow industry to and other businesses to use the water as they to create jobs, frankly,
mm-hmm.
and keep the economy fueled, the water-based economy. And then as for the Chicago diversion, according to the International Joint Commission, which is a body that oversees water controversies between the U.S. and Canada, a study was done, and the Chicago diversion in its current level of 2.1 billion gallons a day lowered Lakes Michigan and Huron by 2.5 inches.
Huh.
Just 2.5 inches. However, that doesn't sound like much, but when you think of the surface area of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, huge surface area, it's a lot of water. It's a lot of water, and it's a lot of impact. And so the point being, though, if we continue to allow things like that to happen, you have a couple more Chicago diversions, not very long, where you get to a foot, And then you start throwing in the climate change scenarios we discussed earlier and the natural variability. And for every inch, by the way, for every inch of water that's lost in the lake levels, the giant ore freighters that take iron ore and taconite from the North Shore of Minnesota and the Upper Peninsula to the steel mills in the southern parts of the lake, they have to shave an inch of cargo out of their 1,000-foot holds. So we're talking about, you know, hundreds of tons of cargo that's lost on every trip, which increases the cost of steel, increases the cost of electricity when they're shipping coal and that sort of thing. So that's an example of the economic costs. And then you add in the factor that in New York, where they have major hydro facilities in the lower end of the Great Lakes system, they can calculate the thousands and thousands of dollars that they lose for every inch of water that goes down the Chicago diversion and doesn't go through the hydro facilities in New York State.
Oh.
And Ontario and Quebec.
Interesting. Thanks, Tom. Dick in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, three quickies, I think. you're familiar with probably the author Dempsey's On the Brink.
Yes.
And what's your view on his a fantasy, I guess, or a possible fantasy of, on Lake Huron? Two, Pleasant Prairie and Akron are also allowed to withdraw without returning, as I understand it. How come? And Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, and Akron, Ohio. And how many communities around the Great Lakes take their water out, use it, treat it, and put it back, and what kind of loss is there from that?
Okay.
Okay, those are good questions. I'm going to take the diversion ones on. I can't remember what Dave Dempsey's Huron scenario was, so I'm sorry about that. But when we talk about Pleasant Prairie and Akron, those are two chapters in my book, and Pleasant Prairie and Akron both were communities that applied for diversions of Great Lakes water. But actually, contrary to Dick's belief, they do return their water to the Great Lakes. And that was actually a stipulation that was required in advance. Now, Pleasant Prairie was a small community at the time that it applied for its diversion. It had major mortgages or bonds issues on new water treatment plants, and it asked for a delay in its time for returning the water to the Great Lakes watershed, and so that the citizens could pay off that bond issue. And so that runs out in 2009. So, and they're right on schedule. So they anticipate no problems in meeting that. So for a period of time, Pleasant Prairie has been sending some of its water after it's treated into the Mississippi River watershed, but that was a special case. Akron, from the beginning, when it got its diversion of Great Lakes water, it pledged from the beginning to send that water back to the Great Lakes watershed. And I forgot your third question. What was that?
Communities around the lake.
Oh, how many communities around the lake?
Yeah, great question. I don't know the answer, and it depends on whether you're counting groundwater that is tributary to the Great Lakes or whether you're just counting communities that are on the Great Lakes, but it is just scores and scores of them. But when you have these communities that are taking the water out, and then they're using the water, and then it goes to their treatment plants, and then they're sending it back, the figures on what the consumptive use loss is, much of it comes back. It's like 90%, 95% of the water comes back. And that, at least that's the goal, the modern goal that people are setting for these treatment facilities. So, you know, the exceptions are when you have a power plant that brings in water, uses it for cooling, and then it goes up the stack as steam and it evaporates, and that's lost to the system. That's called consumptive use. But these figures are published online by the International Joint Commission on Consumptive Use by state and by province and by lake and those sorts of things. IJC.org is the website. You have to root around a little bit, but there are a lot of reports on there that have those facts and figures on those kinds of things.
All right. Thanks, Dick, for calling. Appreciate it. Peter in Milwaukee, it's your turn now. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Very good show. I was wondering how much we're losing through the St. Lawrence Seaway, that dredging, and if perhaps people who wanted Great Lakes water might be able to participate in repairing that rupture, and then perhaps they could be granted that much water.
Yeah, so what Peter's talking about is it's actually a section in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway on the St. Clair River, which is the, I think this is the one you're talking about, Peter. This is the outlet from Lake Huron that connects Lake Huron to Lake Erie right around the Detroit area, just north of Detroit. And the St. Clair River was dredged by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the early part of the last century and then again in the middle part of the last century for navigation. And what has been interesting is that property owners in Canada on the northern part of Lake Huron, a very shallow area, were just a fascinating, wonderful place. There are 30,000 islands in northern Lake Huron, big vacation destination for people from the Toronto metropolitan area. And they've been living, so we have people on these islands who used to have to boat to their cottages, and now they can drive there because the water levels on Lake Huron have fallen so far in these shallow water areas. Very alarming, completely changes your experience at your cottage when you drive where you used to canoe. And so they hired a consultant, an engineer. They started to worry about these dredging issues, and they hired a Blue Ribbon Consulting engineering firm from Toronto, the Toronto metropolitan area, to study the dredging work that had been done at the outlet of Lake Huron, the St. Clair River. And what that engineering firm found, to the shock of a lot of people, is that this dredging had been expanded over time by erosion, underwater erosion, which, if you think about it, so you've got the St. Clair River's like the drain in the bathtub, and that drain had opened and become wider. So the original dredging lowered, when we talked about the Chicago diversion, lowering the Great Lakes by 2.5 inches, the Corps of Engineers admits that that original dredging on the St. Clair River lowered Lakes Michigan and Huron by 18 inches.
Wow.
And this scouring, this erosion underwater now, is believed to have possibly almost doubled the water loss from Lakes Huron and Michigan. So this is a huge issue. And that's why when people talk about dredging the connecting channels, as opposed to a harbor now, but the connecting channels between the lakes, the environmental community becomes very active in this debate. But now the difference, I just want to point out, so this is a huge impact on water levels, because we're basically speeding up the time with which water extricates itself from the Great Lakes system. But that can be engineered back. We can fill that scouring. We can reverse some of those things. If you get a metropolitan area of 7 million people in Chicago that's been dependent on 2.1 billion gallons of a Lake Michigan diversion, that can't be reversed, right? You can't take that water away. So the diversions are much harder to fix, quote-unquote, than some of these engineering mistakes of the past. So long answer to Peter's question, but it's a very good one.
Yeah, good question. Thanks, Peter, for calling. Willem and Colfax, it's your turn. Hi, Willem. Are you there? Whoops, there we go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is really an important issue because, you know, people have been around for eons without electricity or oil, but you can't, life doesn't go on very long without water. And the thing that I thought, you know, I wondered what you had to say about the idea that the Great Lakes, people could say that it belongs to America, just like, you know, we use coal from West Virginia and Kentucky and blow off the top of their mountains so we can have electricity. What's to keep them from saying this is America's water?
Well, that's an interesting question. So what actually, in my opinion, it gets a little bit more provincial than that. I mean, we have people saying this is Ohio's water, and this is Michigan's water, and this is Wisconsin's water. And what makes this so complicated is that we're talking about eight states, two Canadian provinces, and two international countries sharing 20% of the world's fresh surface water. They have to work together to manage this water body. No one can claim the Great Lakes as their own. They just can't do it. No one lake lies completely within one jurisdiction. And that's what's made it so hard over time. That's why the negotiations were so difficult on formulating a compact that would work in all these various jurisdictions on the U.S. side of the border, and then the companion international agreement for the provinces on the Canadian side of the border. Very complicated. Lawyer after lawyer after lawyer with various levels of expertise in international law and water law and property rights and these sort of things, vetted the document thoroughly, et cetera. And that's the issue here, is that it's not just ours. It's a community resource. And it may, you know, one could argue that it's good that we have to work together with others to make the right decisions here, because, you know, it's these communal decisions that can often be the most sustainable over time, I think.
Yeah. Thanks, Willem, for calling. Sherry in Port Wing, hello to you.
Hi. I hope your guest can clarify some things for me. Back in the 1980s, I lived in Northwest Michigan, and the Sea Grant agent for that area gave me a copy of the Corps of Engineers plans for Great Lakes water diversion to the west. And I don't know if those plans have become defunct or if they're just sitting in mothballs. I don't know. A couple of things also. I was told at the time that there was a possibility that no matter what the states and Canada decided, that federal law could supersede the compact or state or provincial law if they declared a state of emergency for western lands. And the next part of the question is, of course, we know that western lands that have been artificially irrigated have begun to salinate. And then there was a third rumor going around at the time when this is an immense book. You may have seen it, this Corps of Engineers thing. I sat up an entire horrifying night reading it. But that the actual purpose that the federal government wanted to do this diversion to the western lands was because of the potential to use a great amount of water for fluming of uranium mines.
Okay.
Peter, are you familiar?
Yeah, there's a lot in those questions, a lot of layers, and I'm trying to figure out how to answer them shortly. So the main Corps of Engineers proposal was to divert water from in the late 70s, early 80s, to divert water from adjacent areas to the Oglala Aquifer, to recharge the Oglala Aquifer on the High Plains. And the Oglala Aquifer is one of the largest aquifers in the world. It stretches all the way from South Dakota in the north to Texas in the south. And it had been suffering from severe water shortages in the 70s. The water level drops of 100 feet or more because of overpumping for pivot irrigation. And this is an area of the country at the time that 40% of U.S. beef was brought to market. And so it had a lot of political power in Congress, and the Congress, through the pressure of that delegation, forced the Corps of Engineers through legislation to study diverting water from quote-unquote adjacent areas to recharge the Oglala Aquifer. Highly controversial in the quote-unquote adjacent areas because that wasn't defined. And South Dakota being a Oglala state bordering Minnesota, a Great Lakes state, this created a lot of alarm in the Great Lakes region. Is this the wolf at the door for Great Lakes water? And to make a long story short, because of the controversy, the Corps decided that it would study diverting water from immediately adjacent watersheds, which would not include the Great Lakes, which was comforting. And what they found was that it would cost between $3 billion and $27 billion to divert water just from these immediate areas uphill to the High Plains. And so those are 1977 dollars. We're talking about a lot more billions today. And the point being that the Corps essentially told the delegation for the Oglala Aquifer that it's just too expensive. It just costs way too much to move water uphill was encouraging more sustainable water use practices in the Oglala area.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and you have a fascinating book, Peter. I thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for the interest.
And again, Peter will be speaking tonight in St. Paul at the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Center for Community Building. And that's on Robbie Street in St. Paul. And then he'll be speaking tomorrow night in Madison at the Madison Club, 5 East Wilson Street, tomorrow evening at 7 as well. Each event is free, open to the public. And certainly take some time and go and see him if you're in the area. and take a look at his book. It's titled The Great Lakes Water Wars. It's published by Island Press, and the author, Peter Annan. Pleased to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking rail safety issues in Wisconsin with Rod Cruden, Wisconsin's Commissioner of Railroads. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.